Hello, you're listening to an audio guide to ancient Rome. Each episode in this series gives you the history and a short tour of a site in the Eternal City, in the hope that you can make the most of your visit. For a map of the locations covered, go to rome-podcast.com. My name is Darren Green, and in this episode I'm describing the Ara Pacis. The Ara Pacis is a sacrificial altar commissioned by the Roman Senate on July the 4th, 13 BCE, to honour the triumphal return of Emperor Augustus from his campaigns in Hispania and Gaul, those are regions that we would now refer to as Spain and France. It took 4 years to build and was consecrated on January the 30th in the year 9 BCE. To celebrate the peace and prosperity in the Roman Empire after Augustus's victories, and to act as a visual reminder of the Julio-Claudian dynasty that brought them about. The altar was originally located on the west side of what is now the Via del Corso, previously called Via Flaminia, at the spot along the eastern side of the church, San Lorenzo in Lucina. The sacrificial altar, made of white marble, is set within a rectangular enclosure about 10 metres by 6 metres, with sculpted friezes inside and out. As with statues, in ancient times the friezes would have been richly painted with vibrant colours. Today they're plain white, but the Museum of Ara Pacis occasionally holds a special event during the evening where the imagined colours are projected onto the reconstruction. Fragments of the Ara Pacis were discovered in 1568 beneath the church and found their way to museums and villas such as the Louvre, the Uffizi Gallery, the Vatican Museums, and Villa Medici. These pieces were identified in the 19th century as belonging to the same monument. Then in 1903 the excavations were continued and decorated panels were identified as being part of the Ara Pacis mentioned in Augustus's memoirs. Excavation under the church and the adjacent Teatro Olimpia continued, and led to the extraction of large surviving parts of the altar and a much better understanding of its shape and dimensions, allowing a reconstruction to be made in 1938. Unfortunately, this work was rushed to completion by Mussolini, resulting in a number of errors. The rebuild required a lot of modern materials, but even with a small number of original pieces, what remains allows high confidence that what you see is a faithful reconstruction. It is housed in a specially designed modern glass and marble museum that opened in 2006. The building was designed by the company of celebrated architect Richard Mayer, and you may encounter students of architecture on the steps outside the museum as they come to study and sketch the design of the building, its courtyard and fountain. On the outer east side of the museum, there is a large inscription of the Res Gestae Divi Augusti, the deeds of the divine Augustus, a personal account of his life and his accomplishments, authored by Augustus himself. The inscription faces Augustus's mausoleum. Unfortunately, the mausoleum is currently closed for restoration. From here on, this tour assumes that you've made it to the museum. Once inside, you will see that the Ara Pacis dominates the main hall. As well as being at a different location, the altar was originally rotated by 90 degrees, so the altar entrance and steps that currently face south originally faced west. The altar was part of the larger Solarium Augusti, or Augustan sundial, in the field of Mars. It was sited in such a way that the shadow of a giant obelisk at the centre of this massive sundial fell across the marble altar on the 23rd of September. That's Augustus's birthday. Although you can't tell it yet, the altar has two entrances, one that was exclusively for priests, which we will call the ceremonial entrance. It's the one that faces you when you come into the museum. The other is on the opposite side and was for public use, which we will refer to as the back or public entrance. The characters on the upper panel friezes of both entrances are mythological. In contrast, the left and right side panels show processions of recognizable individuals from the time of Augustus. The lower panels consist of floral motifs, and these surround the exterior. The inside walls of the enclosure are divided vertically, with the lower section resembling wood panelling and the upper with decorations of foliage garlands, ox skulls, and religious instruments. For the rest of this tour, we will explore the Arapaches in detail, and I hope you will be surprised by how much we can tell about the scenes and the people it depicts. Look more closely at the ceremonial front that faces the main entrance of the museum. The left side panels are mainly reconstructions, since only small fragments survived. However, the reliefs on the right side are mainly originals. The upper left panel depicts the myth of the foundation of Rome. Romulus and Remus are shown being suckled by the she-wolf, protected on the right by Faustulus, the farmer who adopted and brought up the twins. They are approached on the left by Mars, the god who conceived them, with the Vestal priestess Rhea Silvia. In the centre you can see the fig tree under which the twins were suckled. The talons of a bird can be made out in the tree. In 1938 these were sketched in as those of an eagle, however they could equally belong to a woodpecker which, like the wolf, is sacred to Mars. Mars is shown dressed for war and carrying a spear. His plumed helmet is decorated with a griffin and his breastplate with the head of a gorgon. Very little original material from this frieze has been found, so most of this represents educated guesswork. The relief on the upper right is the most complete of the four upper entrance panels. It shows an elderly Aeneas on the right side of the frieze. He is dressed as a priest, with his head covered as he makes an offering at a rustic altar. The lower part of his right arm has been lost, but it almost certainly held a patera, a type of ritual cup. This idea is supported by the presence of a young acolyte who is carrying a tray of fruit and bread, and in his right hand a jug. A second acolyte to his right is driving a sow to the sacrifice. The shrine above them in the background has two seated male figures inside. The scene is probably taking place where the city of Lavinium was founded, as recounted in Virgil's Aeneid, which describes the moment when Aeneas, newly arrived in Italy, sacrificed a sow and her piglets to Juno. It has recently been suggested, however, that the figure making the sacrifice is Numa Pompilius, the second of the seven kings of Rome who celebrated peace between the Romans and the Sabines in the field of Mars by sacrificing a sow. Numa has a reputation for promoting peace, having built the Temple of Janus, whose doors he insisted remain open during times of war, but closed during peacetime. Staying at the ceremonial front, let's look at the lower sections. Like the other three sides, these consist of a floral frieze with spirals of ivy that come out of a burst of acanthus leaves at the bottom center and have two swans at the top left and right. Look closely at the lower panels and you'll find some fun features peculiar to each. For example, the lower right panel has a bird facing left, standing on a leaf. Now let's look at the public entrance, so work your way around to the back. You're now looking at the entrance that faced the Via Flaminia in the altar's original location. The road was at a higher level, so no steps are needed on this side. Also, this was the side most familiar to the ancient public and was therefore the viewpoint typically shown on any coins that celebrated the monument. From some of the coins, we know that the upper entablature, that's the topmost band running around the monument, was taller and flared outward much more than the reconstruction currently shows. To the upper left is a panel depicting Tellus, or Mother Earth, or, according to a different interpretation, Venus, Aeneas' divine mother and the founder of the Julian family, of which Augustus himself was a member. Yet another reading interprets this central figure as Pax Augusta, the embodiment of Augustan peace from which the altar takes its name. The goddess sits on a rock, dressed in a lightweight, loose-fitting garment. Her veiled head supports a crown of fruit and flowers, and at her feet are an ox resting and a sheep grazing. Two cherubs hover at the goddess's side. Her gaze is turned towards one of them, holding out an apple. In her lap, a cluster of grapes and pomegranates finishes off the portrait of a fertility goddess, responsible for the flourishing of mankind, animals, and plants. At the sides of the panel, two young women are shown. The one on the right is sitting on a sea snake or dragon. The one on the left is on a flying goose or swan. These are symbols of the gentle winds of the sea and earth, respectively. Beneath the figure on the swan are grasses and an overturned jug pouring out water with a heron perched on its handle. On the upper right side of the entrance, a fragment of a relief of a goddess survives. Her figure has been completed by sketching in on the mortar. Since she is seated on a pile of weapons, this must be the goddess Roma. The weapons have been confiscated from the enemy, thereby forcing peace. Her presence on the altar should be read in close conjunction with that of the Venus or Tellus figure, since prosperity and peace are guaranteed by Roma victorious. The goddess is represented as an Amazon. On her head she wears a helmet and her right breast is bared. A baldric hangs across her shoulder and in it a short sword. In her right hand she holds a spear. Honor to her right and virtue to her left were very probably also depicted in the scene, positioned on either side of the goddess in the form of two young masculine divinities. This is the least intact of the four mythological reliefs that flank the entrances. Only two original fragments survived, a draped thigh with the lap of a seated figure facing left, and a shield covering the figure's right knee. From this, everything else has been conjectured, but there seems to be agreement among historians that this reconstruction makes sense and is generally correct. The lower left panel on the entrance has a couple of notable features. Look closely and you will see two small birds facing each other. There's also a snail, a scorpion, and a worm on the acanthus leaves at the bottom. You can also find a salamander and a frog on the bottom acanthus leaves to the left of center. Crossing over, the lower right panel has a grasshopper to the left of the stalk and just above the acanthus leaves, a bird to the right of the stalk, another bird at the bottom of the stalk with another grasshopper below it, and a worm to their left. We've looked at the front and back. Now let's focus on the sides of the enclosure. The upper panels of the left and right sides show two dense crowds of people moving from the public entrance at the back toward the ceremonial front. They appear to represent a single, slow-moving procession viewed from both sides, rather than being different parts of a procession or two different processions. Among them are priests, acolytes of the Roman cults, magistrates, men, women, and children, whose identities can be determined reasonably well. That said, it's not entirely clear what the procession is doing. Some think that the scene shows Augustus's return, specifically the ceremony of welcome paid to him at his return from his long absence in Gaul and Hispania. Others think it represents the inauguration of the Arapachis itself. The procession begins with the lictors, followed by members of the priestly schools and perhaps by the consuls. Immediately after this come members of Augustus's family. To help you get oriented, we will now refer to the left and right sides as you walked into the museum and face the altar. We will start with the right side, as this is the side with Augustus. The procession is walking from the back or public entrance towards the ceremonial front, which on this side means they are walking from your right to your left. Starting with the figures at the head of the procession, we have some very fragmented carvings of lictors. These are the emperor's bodyguards. Although damaged by the cornerstone of the palazzo built on top of the original site of the Arapacis, Augustus's face and head are complete enough to be positively identified. He is crowned with laurel. He's also slightly larger and given a little more space than any of the others. The best way to pick him out is by looking for the first figure where only half of the body remains. More specifically, he's missing half of his body from the shoulders down. Here, Augustus is represented as Pontifex Maximus, or High Priest, veiled and acting in his official capacity, ready to help perform a sacrifice. The Rex Sacrorum, which literally means King of the Sacred, is close behind him. Four Flamines Maiores, chief priests with leather headgear with a chin strap topped with an olive branch and a metal point, are easily identified and follow behind. These represent the four state cults: Mars, Quirinus, deified Julius Caesar, and Jupiter, with a stick in his right hand. The first two are wearing rings on their left hands. Look for a figure with a ritual axe on his shoulder. This is the Flaminius lictor who will kill the sacrificial bull or some other animal. We can also identify Marcus Agrippa with his head covered by the edge of his toga, which is held with his left hand. He has a roll of parchment in his right hand. Agrippa was Augustus's right-hand man, his friend, and also his son-in-law, being his daughter Julia's second husband. Like Augustus, Agrippa is veiled, signifying that he is acting in his official capacity as a priest. Right behind Agrippa is his young son Gaius Caesar, shown as a child holding onto his father's clothes. Agrippa and Julia's other son, therefore Augustus's second grandchild, was Lucius Caesar. Gaius and Lucius were adopted by their grandfather with the intention that they would succeed him, although their deaths, perhaps at the hands of Livia, Augustus's wife, ruined this plan, resulting in the rise to power of Tiberius, who was Livia's son. Gaius is turned toward the rear of the procession, looking at the woman behind him, who is either Julia, his mother, or Livia, his grandmother. She is depicted veiled and crowned with laurel, which marks her as a woman of high rank. Some scholars believe the child is not Gaius, as his necklace and long hair suggest that he is non-Roman, perhaps a barbarian prince from the east who is a guest or a hostage of Rome. Tiberius is usually identified as the male figure in the foreground following Julia or Livia. However, there is some doubt to this, as the figure is wearing plebeian shoes, quite inappropriate for one of the noble families of Rome. Two people behind Julia or Livia, there is a seam or line in the reconstruction, which gives a discontinuity in the carvings. It is believed that this is a flaw resulting from the rushed reconstruction, and that a panel is missing, which also means that the sparse fragments at the left edge of this frieze should be closer together. The figures in this final third of the upper panel are thought to be members of Augustus's family, but can't be conclusively identified. The next child after Gaius is thought to be the infant Germanicus, who is holding the toga of his mother, Antonia the Younger, Augustus's niece. The man she is looking at, behind her, is her husband and Germanicus's father, Drusus. Drusus is the only figure to be shown in military dress. At the time the altar was commissioned, Drusus was occupied in fighting the Germanic tribes to the east of the Rhine. A second family group follows, made up in a similar fashion by Antonia the Elder, another of Augustus's nieces, the second person behind Drusus, shown as a woman whose head is draped with a hood. The man in the foreground behind her is Lucius Domitian Enobarbus, who was consul in 16 BCE, and is the second-to-last person on this frieze. Between Antonia the Elder and him are their children, Domitia, the taller of the two, and Gnaeus Domitian Enobarbus, the future father of Nero. Now walk around to the other side of the enclosure. This should be the left side as you walked into the museum. Focusing on the upper panel, the first thing to note is that most of the heads on this side have been restored. The leading two foreground figures are lictors carrying fasces. These are bundles of rods, symbolizing how unity brings strength. This is also the source of the modern word fascism. Next are the augurs, who are responsible for interpreting the omens in public life, and the septemviri epulones, the seven priests in charge of religious banquets, identified by the incense box they carry. One of the seven is not shown, where there is a gap in the frieze. Next are 21 members of the Quindicemviri Sacris Feciundis, Roman priests in charge of the Sibylline books, which are a collection of prophecies. There is a Camillus, or adolescent boy, who is an assistant to the priests. He's carrying an incense box. To have the full set, there should be two other priests, but we've already seen them on the right side of the enclosure. They are Augustus and Agrippa. The leftmost portion of the upper frieze consists of members of the imperial family. The veiled figure, the first figure with missing legs, might be Julia, daughter of Augustus, or Livia, if Julia is on the other side. The child just on her right might be Lucius Caesar. The man behind her, child behind her, and faded figure behind them are unknown, though the child might be Gaius Caesar. The next woman, with barely any detail remaining on her head, is Octavia Minor. The child behind her is Julia Minor, and the adult touching her head is either Julius Antonius, a son of Mark Antony, or Marcus Epuleius. Next, behind him, with basically only a right arm, is thought to be Marcella Major, daughter of Octavia Minor. The final figure at the left edge is a child, possibly Lucius Antonius. This left side lower panel has several surprises in the depths of the vegetation. The following creatures can be found working from left to right. Under the central acanthus leaves, a snake attacking a nest of chicks, with a lizard above, a single bird escaping the nest, another lizard, and a frog. Now let's move inside. The Arapachis is made up of a rectangular enclosure which surrounds the true altar. It thus follows the pattern of a templum minus, which is described by Festo like this. The templum minora were created by the augurs, who encircled the chosen places with wooden panels or with drapery, so that they only had one entrance, and demarcated the space with the customary formulae. The temple, therefore, is an enclosed space consecrated in such a way that it is open on one side and has its corners clearly determined on the ground. Except for the fact that this altar has two entrances, this description fits the monument closely. Even its internal decoration shows in the lower parts the wooden boards that defined the consecrated space. The interior of the enclosure, like the exterior, is divided into two panels placed one above the other and separated by a band. On this inside, the band is made of palmettes. In the lower panels, the decoration is a simple version of the planks from the traditional wooden enclosures. The higher panels are richly adorned with festoons and ox skulls, interspersed with paterae, or libation bowls. These motifs are related to the decorations that were placed above the traditional wooden enclosures, in this case, garlands heavily weighed down with ears of corn, with wild and cultivated berries and fruits attached to the supports by ribbons. The interior is further decorated with pilasters. These are the square columns attached to the wall that are topped with Corinthian capitals. If you look at the interior corners, you'll see that the pilasters are folded and the ox skulls are divided in half. At the center of the Arapachis is the grand altar table on which animals were sacrificed and wine was offered to the gods. The table takes up almost all of the internal space. Between the altar and the enclosure, there is only a narrow walkway, with the floor sloping gently towards the enclosure walls to allow rainwater and the wine, blood and water used in the ritual of sacrifice to flow out through drainage holes along the edge. The altar stands on a podium of four steps, on top of which is the altar base, with another four steps at the front. Above this rises the altar table, closed between side shelves. The two side supports are decorated with actoria in the form of floral patterns and winged lions. On the inside of the left side wall of the central altar, there are six Vestal Virgins shown with their heads covered. Appointed by the Pontifex Maximus and selected from the daughters of the aristocracy, these girls started out between the ages of 6 and 10 and remained the guardians of the sacred flame for 30 years. Here they are shown in order of decreasing height and presumably age, flanked by male figures. They appear to be preparing for a religious sacrifice. The opposite side of the altar has only a single fragment remaining. It shows two figures. The first is a priest, or more precisely a flamen, while the figure following him is sometimes identified as Augustus, and possibly shows him as Pontifex Maximus, a position which he assumed in 12 BCE while the Arapachis was being built. Griffins are shown on the back of the altar, but unfortunately very little of the frieze on this side remains. On the outside of the left support, a procession of three animals has survived, an ox, bull, and ram. These are being led to the sacrifice by 12 adepts, or victimarii, in short, tunics. In their hands they hold sacrificial instruments, trays, a knife, a club, and laurel for aspersion. They are preceded by a man wearing a toga, perhaps a priest, accompanied by helpers and acolytes of the cult. Griffins appear at the right and left edge of the altar. The fragments of the altar frieze probably refer to a particular sacrifice, perhaps that of the Pax Augusta itself, which the Senate had decreed should be celebrated every year on the 30th of January, commemorating the consecration of the altar. Our tour of the Arapachis ends here, but do check out the other related displays in the museum. There are two in particular that help further understand the context and history. Just inside the entrance, there is a scale model that shows where the Arapachis was positioned in relation to the Augustan sundial. This helps understand how the altar fit into the general landscape of ancient Rome. Secondly, there is a well-made and relatively short film that details the altar's rediscovery and restoration. Other adjacent tours in this podcast series are the Castel Sant'Angelo and the Mausoleum of Augustus. I'd like to thank Jeff Bondono, who gathered key information and drafted sections of this episode. Jeff's website, jeffbondono.com, provides a comprehensive picture archive of pretty much all the historical sites in Rome. His photos have great accompanying information, and I recommend you checking out his site before or after your visit, as it will help you decide where to go or remind you of details you've seen. Thanks, Jeff, for permission to use your material.